Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday morning. Monday morning, April 25th, 2022. And of course, what Monday morning means is a discussion with Jimmy Saxon of the Esquire Group in Dubai, where we continue our tour through the great book, Charles Adams, For Good and Evil, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. And this week we have reached the great lesson 19, which is actually very thought-provoking, very timely. And frankly, what a great deal of the discussion in the political sphere is doing today. And here it is, 19, the income tax is a bastardized form of wealth taxation, because the more wealth a taxpayer possesses, the easier it is to avoid taxable income. A person's wealth and ability to pay do not necessarily bear any relation to taxable income. Well, my God, I suppose truer words were never spoken. Well, what do you think about that, Jimmy?
Well, I mean, I think it's very true, right? I mean, I think if you look at some of, you know, we've had this big leak in the United States that I think was it ProPublica or something's been publishing the leaked tax records from the IRS that shows that many of the U.S.'s billionaires have paid very little income taxes in the last decade or so because they're able to borrow against their wealth and avoid taxable income.
Well, I think there's two things that they're saying. I mean, it's not clear to me they're saying they're not paying a lot of tax. I think some of them probably are. What they are saying is, relative to their assets and their economic power, they're not paying a lot of tax. I think Warren Buffett's, well, you know, my secretary pays higher tax than I do. I think he meant a higher tax rate.
For sure. He meant percentage, because most of his income would be capital gains or qualified dividends, you know, which capped out at 20%, where I think at the time that he made that statement, the highest tax rate in the United States was 39.6 on the federal level.
Yeah. In any case, I think this might be a useful starting point, because as we, you know, at least as I read this stuff and absorb it, and you know, I think about it both from the perspective of how taxation works in the U.S., but also in Canada. And, you know, having grown up in Canada, of course, I'm used to a system where, you know, their view sort of a buck is a buck type of thing, you know, that doesn't really distinguish forms of income the way it does in the United States. And I don't know if that makes a lot of sense or not. I mean, I can understand the policy arguments for this both ways, but it does seem to me that in a very real sense, one of the perks of acquiring assets is that you can pay less tax on the income you generate from them. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, yes, it does. However, I would say that I think, clearly the capital gains tax existed when this book was written, but I think there's also the definition of taxable income, right? I mean, I think that, you know, when you go back in history, taxable income was traditionally earned income, right? And then, capital gains and all that stuff, they started reclassifying as income later. I mean, when you look at a lot of European countries, I mean, for example, you know, Austria is one such country, most capital gains were exempted completely up until about 10 years ago because it wasn't viewed as income, right? So, I mean, Austria was one of those places where it was like, okay, you pay a very high tax rate on your earned income, but there was, you know, some tax advantages to income generated by appreciation in capital assets, right? Now they've changed that. And now they have a capital gains taxes like most places. But even in Germany, I believe there's still some exemptions to capital gains tax, right? So I think that there's also the point that, you know, we've kind of moved from taxable income generally being income generated, you know, earned income, to include all other types of income, including those that really aren't real income, right? An appreciation of a taxable asset, I mean, really is a capital appreciation. I don't really believe that that should be income, although they've morphed it into that. And now, of course, in the United States, they want to even say that the appreciation of the assets without a realization event is taxable income, right? So I think you first really need to look at, you know, what is taxable income?
Yeah, well, what kind of income is it appropriate to tax? Well, you know, you put it that way. And I mean, I would agree with you that for the most part, unless you're dealing with short-term speculation, that to impose taxes on capital gains is probably just to impose a tax on appreciation through inflation, right?
Yeah.
So if we look at it from that point of view, could one not argue that, let's say we have two taxpayers, one with $100,000 annual income, a second with a long-term capital gain of $100,000, perhaps we could argue that in fact, the income earner, the capital gains earner is actually paying a higher tax than the income earner because the capital gain shouldn't be taxed at all, right?
Well, and I would add on top of that, that, you know, if you want to go back before that, right, the capital gain earner had to first earn income and pay taxes on it in order to be able to buy the asset that went up in value, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, I agree with you on that as well. All right, so let's step back. I mean, this is a very interesting discussion, sort of from first principles. I mean, what is or what should income be? And, you know, of course, it becomes very problematic when you get these, you probably haven't thought about this case recently, but I'm positive in your tax studies, you would have read the Glenshaw Gas Gate, whatever that glass case, right? You know, at some point where, you know, I think the court decision was that basically any, you know, any increase in net worth or something like that, right, you know, was fair game as income. And, you know, that's bad. Okay. But then we move it forward into things like the whole subpart F regime and that. I mean, it's one thing to say that any increase in net worth is income, but then the question becomes, should that include income that has not even been realized, right?
Well, for sure.
So this is very, very problematic. So let's start from the principle that we're not going to discuss it today, but the more I talk about this, the more I think income taxation is a bad idea, period.
No, for sure. And I mean, again, this isn't a topic for today, but, you know, when you look at a wealth tax, I mean, a wealth tax is essentially a poll tax, right? I mean, you have to pay for breathing, essentially, right? On whatever you have.
Yeah, well, it's a citizenship taxation is a poll tax. I'm a citizen, therefore I'm taxed. You know, that is right. So the context of this is taking place, and this is why I think it's critical these damn tax codes, you know, get updated every 25, 30 years at least. I mean, the U.S. and Canada, we're dealing with tax systems that, in all seriousness, I think should be viewed as simply archaic. You know, they just have, you know, gone on for years and years. And what's happening is that there's greater and greater inequality. And of course, through the political process, there are greater and greater attempts to bring more things into the definition of income, I think, right?
For sure.
So we have all over North America, very wealthy people with very, very low taxable incomes. In fact, if you live in Canada, you would want low taxable income.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, I mean, if you're getting paid mostly in interest and in dividends, at least in the United States, you're certainly paying a lower tax, right? I mean, even in most European countries, investment income is taxed at a lower rate than earned income, right? I mean, sometimes as much as half. So certainly if you're restructuring, if you have more wealth, you're able to generate income that's subject to a lower capital gains, or sorry, to a lower income tax rate, or you're able to borrow against your wealth and just not have any income at all if you have enough.
Well, especially if the interest rates that exist today.
Well, existed. They're going up slowly here.
Yeah, but I mean, even if they went up a good deal, I think for a lot of people it would make a lot of sense, because aren't you really just comparing interest payments versus taxation on income?
For sure. Well, so, yeah, and I mean, look, and the reality is, I mean, it's one thing, you know, if you mortgage your house, but I think, you know, when you're an ultra wealthy person and, you know, you're borrowing, you know, you have a line of credit set up with your private banker, I mean, you're not even really paying the interest, right? It's just sort of deducted from your line of credit. So you don't even really notice that you're paying it, right? You're just essentially getting less loan proceeds over the long term because of the interest component.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, bottom line, it is very, very clear, because everybody does it, or enough people do it, that to borrow against assets makes more financial sense than realizing income and paying tax on it, right?
100%.
Okay, so do you think that, I mean, if you were rethinking taxation from the ground up, and let's assume that we're going to start with an income tax, that it will have an income tax component. How do you think it should be structured?
Well, I mean, look, I have a couple thoughts on this. I mean, one thought is that there should be a flat tax, right? Just no deductions, nothing, just a flat tax on your income, right? And that could be earned income, could be dividends, could be interest. Capital gains should not be included. Wealth should not be included. But basically, earned income and income from the exploitation of your assets.
Okay. And presumably, your point would be that would sort of broaden the base. We're going to keep it simple. We're not going to have deductions. So, well, you would view this as sort of a revenue tax.
I would view it as a revenue tax. And I think, one, it's much easier to implement. And I have a moral belief that everybody needs to pay something. If you're enjoying the benefits of living in a society, the protection, the infrastructure, the things that are going, you need to have some skin in the game. And whether, you know, even if you're contributing a tiny amount of money, I think everybody needs to have a vested interest and needs to pay up.
So would it then be your view that, you know, say we have a wealthy, extremely wealthy individual who just continually borrows and pays zero tax, probably doesn't even file a tax return, actually, right?
Yeah, probably not.
You know, because, sure, if the income is below the standard deduction, right? Your view would be that person should be paying some tax in some way or another.
Well, I think my view is this. Yes, he should. Everybody's got to have some skin in the game. However, I would also argue that if the income tax was a fair flat tax, I don't think that wealthy people would go to such lengths to avoid it, because it just wouldn't be worth it. I think if they could pay, you know, most wealthy people I know, if they could just pay 20% taxes and not have to worry about it, they would do it. And I think that there would be so many business opportunities for them. I think there would be so many business opportunities for them that would be generating income that they wouldn't forego those opportunities and say, no, I'm not going to do those because of the taxes. I'd rather borrow against my wealth. I think they would engage in the business activity and pay the tax.
I think that's probably right. I agree with you. I think what you're saying is that a huge part of the problem here, and a huge determiner, if you will, of this behavior, is just how high income tax rates are.
For sure.
You know, just
and not just how high they are, John, but how complicated they are, right?
Yeah.
If I'm a super wealthy guy and I just borrow against my wealth, I have a really easy tax return and I don't need to worry about being audited, right? Like, what is there to audit? This is my wealth. I borrowed against it.
Yeah.
But you also have the huge compliance risk.
Well, that is true. I mean, for years and years, my personal view of this has been that it would be a lot smarter to just have to change the income tax to some sort of a revenue tax, get rid of the deductions, you know, a relatively low tax. It would broaden the tax base considerably. It would get people out of all these compliance problems.
I mean, listen, to be quite honest with you, like, I'm not completely against a flat-out poll tax, right? Like, I don't think government should have an unlimited budget, right? Like, you should be able to fund a military for defense only. You should be able to pay for infrastructure. You should be able to pay for, you know, governance and a police force and stuff like that. But a government's not supposed to have an unlimited budget, right? To me, you should figure out what it costs to properly run a government for what is actually need and what the citizens actually want. Then that should be divided up amongst the citizens, and they need to figure out how to pay it.
You know, what you're describing is really the way, at least in Ontario where I live, the basis of municipal taxation, right? So, for example, you know, the city of Toronto decides, you know, they have to provide this services at this level, and then they just look at the tax base as a property tax thing here. Mm-hmm. And they say, all right, you know, so here's the multiplier we're going to use on the values, you know, to get there. Yep. What they're not doing with that type of system is using the tax system, the tax code, as a way to punish people, though.
Yeah, correct.
And I saw an amazing thing this week, absolutely amazing. Some proposed legislation coming out of Rhode Island, basically putting a tax punishment on anybody who didn't get a COVID-19 vaccine, right? I mean, leaving aside your view of the vaccine issue, that seems, you know, to me to be a completely improper use of the tax code.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were proposing the same thing in the province of Quebec and Canada.
Well, I mean, I read it. I think there was an article, I want to say, in Bloomberg, that was talking about, you know, how the IRS is really struggling to deal with all of these sort of social initiatives that have been put on it, right? Like the COVID relief and all this stuff. And I mean, I think that's, you know, when you want to talk about something bastardized, I mean, that's what they're doing, right? I mean, they're trying to completely administer all sort of benefits and penalties and everything against citizens through the tax agencies.
Well, it's become the principal sort of social tool of communicating with people, of punishing them, of rewarding them. I mean, you know, frankly, I think a tax break is just as bad as a tax punishment, you know, in the sense that it really just pollutes the integrity of the whole thing. And, you know, what is it you're trying to do with these tax systems? But I think where we are definitely in agreement, but I would have known we were in agreement on this point anyway, would be that a big part of the problem is how high the income tax rates are, and why that provides incentive for these other things. So, you know, what do? You bring down the rate. I think you make it a revenue tax. By making it a revenue tax without deductions and stuff like that, you get people completely out of this compliance nightmare.
Yep.
And you think so based on your view of this revenue tax, I think I understood you to be saying that basically interest income and employment income would be taxed at the same rate.
Yeah, I mean, I would even go so far as dividends, right? Because dividends, but I would also say that the revenue tax should not apply to corporations, right? All corporations should essentially be, you know, kind of pass-through entities, right? I mean, I think the corporations would add more to the economy if they weren't taxed and they had their full resources to reinvest. And then whatever is distributed to the taxpayers, to the investors, would then be taxed, right? Because that's essentially business profits. And I think it also sort of, I think the companies have largely become a scapegoat, right? Because they're not a natural person. They're this sort of thing that, you know, even if you equalize the taxes amongst the population on a revenue tax, people are going to say, you know, then they're going to say, oh, we should raise the corporate tax rates. The corporations should pay for it, right? You have to put everything on the citizens and residents. And so you got to abolish the corporate income tax altogether. And the citizens have to pay tax on the income from the businesses.
Whether it's distributed to them or not?
Well, I think that there needs to be, I think it needs to be distributed. I think they should only pay tax on distributed income. And probably there needs to be some rules, something like the accumulated earnings tax, but not so restrictive, that there needs to be a business purpose for stockpiling cash, essentially, right? That would be my way of doing it.
Okay, so but it sounds like your thought on that, I think, is basically based on the following. One, a corporation is a fiction. What matters would be the shareholders. Two, therefore, this should operate at the level of shareholder taxation. Yep. Three, you would not go so far as to say they should pay tax if it hasn't been distributed. You know, that's sort of where you are on that, I think. But on the other hand, four, the corporations cannot hold on to the retained earnings indefinitely for the purpose of deferring the tax on the shareholders. I think that's what you're saying, right?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay. All right. That's an interesting way to look at it. Again, you know, anything that can be summarized that way suggests it's simple enough.
Yeah.
You know, which is also is a good thing. I mean, as you point out time and time again, it's the complexity of this stuff that's the problem.
Well, and I think one of the things that really, and I forget, you know, it's been a while since I've read this book now, but I think one of the things that Charles Adams points out, and I forget whose tax system it was, I mean, it may have been in the Roman Empire or something, but, you know, what sticks in my mind is there was basically sort of a flat, I want to say a 7% tax or something that applied in one tax system. And the revenues from this were, you know, bigger than the super complex ones, right? Because it just wasn't worth it to not comply with it, right? And so the Treasury was getting these huge revenues and everything. And then, you know, a new ruler came in and got greedy. And all of a sudden, you know, income, great wealth, as if by magic, disappears, you know, as it said in one of these lessons. Well,
of course, not by magic. It's by government. It's not by magic. I mean, as long as we have government,
great wealth, as if by magic, disappears when governments adopt taxation to serve the rich. And I think that's true, right? I think these governments would have much more success and much more revenue.
Sounds like Elizabeth Warren. Sounds like you're talking about Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Isn't that her goal?
Oh, yeah. She's her and AOC.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let me ask you this. Interestingly, in 1986, which some people call a major tax reform, I don't know how major it was, but the idea was basically to get the rates down, sort of broaden the tax base, okay? But what they forgot to do was, get rid of these deductions and stuff like that. And they created things. This is the origin of the PFIC rules, for example, you know, it was the 86 tax reform, et cetera. So they they didn't get rid of the complexity. Now, I am wondering if, you know, we've talked about the idea of the fair tax, which is not an income tax, but a sales-based tax. That might be hard to solve politically. Probably it is, mainly for reasons that are not particularly reasonable, just sort of, well, you know, if somebody's making money, they should pay tax, right?
I mean, but, look, I've not really given thought to which tax system would be better. But
well,
I mean,
I'm suggesting it be both side by side. In other words, yeah, let's say you have a relatively low manageable sales tax, a relatively low manageable revenue tax. And the point, and you know, you don't call it an income tax anymore. You call it a revenue tax. So it's clear, you know, that we're getting rid of these, you know, deductions. I mean, you know, your return is very simple. You look at your bank account, you see what went in. I mean, you know, that's it. You know, you pay a percentage. I mean, we're now, I think, in a world where cash is pretty much impossible anyway, right?
Yeah.
You know, at least for 99% of people. So isn't it just a question of, you know, I mean, the existence of the stuff in the bank accounts, because that's the only way you can get it, probably.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, is a built-in audit mechanism to begin with. I mean, what about something like that? You know, it's simplicity, it's predictability, it's not using the tax system to punish anybody anymore.
And everybody in a society is buying something, right? So everybody's paying in.
Well, they're either buying something or they're getting, you know, some form of income. I mean, either way, you know, they're paying stuff, and it's not, you know, and it doesn't seem to me that it is, you know, a mechanism to punish the rich or, you know, reward anybody. It just sort of says, you know, here's what's happening with you, and we're going to keep it simple, and, you know, et cetera. I mean, does that not, you know, particularly in the United States, right, that doesn't have, other than at the state level, a very well-developed concept of a sales tax, right, or a value-added tax.
I mean, yeah, it's a disaster in the U.S.
Yeah, what about that? You know, having those two things simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, I think that can be a good combo as long as both of the rates are reasonable, right? I mean, I think that's fair, right? You pay on what you consume and you pay on your revenue. I think that's perfectly reasonable.
Or at least it's far more reasonable than the rest of the stuff. Now, I want to ask you a question, and I do not know the answer, so I'm not expecting you to know the answer necessarily, but if you do, I'd love to hear it. So, you know, the United States has a truly, truly archaic tax system, largely because the first taxes were transfer taxes, right, before they got the income taxes. And this whole transfer tax thing exists, continues to exist. But what's interesting about it is the way it goes after the assets of non-resident aliens. You know, if you have these, you know, over the 60,000 thing.
Yeah.
And my question for you is, do you know of any other countries that have that? I mean, yeah, not just a transfer tax, but one that's so punitive on the assets of non-residents.
I mean, the UK is very similar, right? If you have assets there, they're subject to inheritance tax on non-residents with a fairly low threshold, from what I recall.
Okay, so the UK, any others that you can think of?
I mean, I think from what I recall, I mean, I think it's not necessarily on the I mean, there's some European countries that tax the beneficiaries on inherited property of non-residents, right? So if you had a vacation home, and I think Spain's one of them.
Yeah, but that's a tax on residents, right? That's still a tax on residents in the country.
I think even if the asset's located there.
So the asset's located there. So my question, though, is, you know, so you have somebody who owns an apartment, small apartment building in the U.S., non-resident alien.
Yeah,
country. Person dies, you know, they want, you know, whatever, yeah, they're 40% of that.
Yep. I believe
it's anyway, clearly it's not a common form of tax.
No. I think the UK is definitely like that. I think Australia was like that before they got rid of the inheritance tax. But Yeah, it's very
well, these other countries have had tax reform. It hasn't been great, but tax reform over the years. And, you know, in the early 70s or whenever it was, when Canada moved to treating transfers of capital assets as deemed sales, capital gains, they got rid of the estate and gift tax.
Right. Which is certainly more reasonable than the U.S.'s system. I mean, the U.S.'s system is really, really draconian against non-resident.
Well, not only is it draconian, but my impression is that most people don't even know this exists. Do you share that view?
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you. I mean, I have a call later today with a guy who has this exact problem, right? I mean, this is actually something that I deal with quite a bit with, you know, a lot of my clients, because pretty much every high net worth individual in the world has a property in the United States. And I would say probably, you know, a good 80% of my new clients that have properties in the US had no idea about this, right? And they own it in their personal names. And it's can be costly to resolve the issue.
And very costly. Very costly. I mean, I had somebody call me recently. It was like $4 or $5 million property they bought, and they put in their names personally. And then, you know, oh my God, you know, they found out what had happened. And, you know, and then you got to try to restructure it. But the problem is they're tax resident of Canada, you know, which means that any attempt to move the thing creates a problem on this side, you know. And
so Canada's difficult, but. You know, one of the things, and I know I've ran into this issue with Canada before. It doesn't work for Canadians, but it works with a lot of countries. You know, are you familiar with this 897i election?
No. What's that?
So there's an election that you can make if the country of residence is a treaty partner country. And basically, you know, normally if you're, you know, one of the big problems is, you know, one of the easiest solutions to this, right, is you put the property into a foreign corporation, the shares of which are not U.S. property for estate tax purposes.
Right.
But usually the property is appreciated. So you trigger a gain recognition event and you got to pay the tax when a capital gains tax, when it goes in, you have the FIRCTA withholding and all this stuff. Well, an 897i election allows you to utilize the non-discrimination provision of the tax treaty with the United States, where essentially what you could do is transfer the property, in this case, and I'm talking about from a US standpoint, right? You can transfer appreciated US property to a US, to a Canadian corporation without triggering any US tax or FIRCTA. And so the company will be treated as a domestic corporation for purposes of FIRCTA, but a foreign corporation for purposes of the estate tax. So you kind of get the best of both worlds. The shareholders have to sign some agreements that, you know, if they sell the shares of the company or something like that, they have to pay the tax. But there's no estate tax, which is the key. So it's a pretty useful provision. If I remember correctly, the problem with it for Canadians is there'll be tax triggered in Canada when you transfer the U.S. property to the Canadian corporation.
That's right.
But that's not the case with, you know, in other jurisdictions. And so that's usually, you know, one of the few ways you can resolve this issue.
All right. That's interesting. Okay. Well, you know, this is a really, really interesting problem. I don't see any change soon on any of these issues at all, because, you know, all the change is political. And again, what we're talking about is lesson 19. The income tax is a bastardized form of wealth taxation, because the more wealth a taxpayer possesses, the easier it is to avoid taxable income. Person's wealth and ability to pay do not necessarily bear any relation to taxable income. I mean, this is absolutely correct. The idea is to, the more wealth you have, the less the more opportunity you have to avoid income taxation, and that's clear.
Yep.
All right. great way to start the week, as always. Any concluding thoughts, and how would people get a hold of you?
My concluding thought is, so far, my favorite tax code is Dubai's tax code, because it doesn't exist. As always, you can find me at EsquireGroup.com.
All right. Well, great discussion, and look forward to connecting with you next week.
Me too, John.